packages. A couple of folks with me from the Boston area, and I've got Boston on my brain because my daughter just got accepted to Boston University, as well as Emerson and Simmons, a couple of other great institutions. She would kill me if she knew I was mentioning this on the air, but it just was funny because my co-host, DR, who unfortunately could not join us this week, has a day job that he has to attend to sometimes. He set this up on Monday for me while I was busy cooking for Passover, so here I had BU bookmarked on my desktop computer, and there you guys were, my guests for today's show, you guys being David Keefe, production manager for BU Today, that is the publication of Boston University, and Leslie Friday, who is a staff writer for BU Today as well, talking about this first-of-its-kind series. It's a three-parter on climate change and the impact of cities on global warming, and specifically, where do our emissions come from, how much do they contribute to the problem, how can we all play a part, really just elucidating and illuminating and illustrating what we can't see, and if we could see all the carbon that was going out into the atmosphere, perhaps we would be waking up and smelling the CO2 in a bigger, louder way than we are. So I decided I think it's a good time to have someone from BU on, a couple of folks, David Keefe and Leslie Friday. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Betsy.
I'm glad to see you're doing such great journalism there. That's what my daughter wants to study. And even though I keep warning her that journalism is not necessarily a secure future, it's so important. And I can't think of anything that's more important than covering what's going on with our environment, our atmosphere, and we cover climate change in one way or another each and every week on the program. And so I thought, you know, let's find out what institutions are doing, you know, where the next generation is being, you know, educated and trained. So you're kind of where both my worlds meet, journalism and climate change. So thanks again for the series, and if you can tell our listeners about what prompted it and perhaps the response to it, we can go from there.
Sure, our pleasure, and thanks for having us on. I guess where this came about, David and I were talking about another story, actually, about Divest BU. It's a student club that's looking at divesting from fossil fuels, or encouraging the university to, anyway. And we just started talking about pretty much the absence of climate change as a discussion in the presidential campaign, and how we had a lot of great BU researchers here who were looking at that same topic, and we started thinking about pulling a bunch of these people together and featuring their work in an entire week-long series. So that's how it came about, and we've had pretty good response so far. We're in the third day. Yesterday we had quite a few comments. I'm sure David could speak to that better than I. He monitors that.
Yes, David, I heard you had comments both pro and con.
Yes, that's right. Both
con as in why are you saying that climate change is a real thing? Was it that bad, or just taking issue with certain details?
Yeah, you know, obviously some people don't believe in the science behind why it's happening. So, you know, both comments from that side and people commenting back saying, you know, 97% of climate scientists agree this is happening and this is why it's happening, just creating the discussion.
Well, that's always a good thing, creating
yeah.
discussion, even if it's still controversial when most of us think it shouldn't be. But tell us the title of each of the articles and what the focus was of each.
Sure. The first story was written by my colleague, Rich Barlow, and it's called, by Cindy Buccini, and it's called Why the Earth is Warming. And it basically addresses the work of one professor named Bruce Anderson, and he takes three hypotheses that are out there about why the Earth could be warming. And he didn't try to prove any particular one. He just tried to disprove them. And he ended up disproving two of them, which maybe are lesser known, and the one that stood was the one that the Earth is warming because of human activity, because of greenhouse gas emissions.
Solar flares or volcanoes?
Perhaps. Yeah, that was one of them, actually, solar flares. I'd never heard of that before, actually, emissions from the atmosphere, and then also just ocean-generated heat. So, say
you don't watch Fox News if you haven't heard about solar flares and volcanoes.
Yeah, I did see you on Hannity and Combs, though. So.
I went on there half dozen times trying to insert a little bit of scientific fact, but they don't really want to know, and don't get me started on that.
Right. The second story was really focusing on Professor Rangamaneni's work, and he had a recent publication in Nature Climate Change about how the seasons and vegetation is changing in the northern hemisphere, so the Arctic and boreal regions, and they're seeing spring coming earlier, winter warming faster than any other season, and vegetation increasing in these areas. But, you know, as he said, mangoes aren't going to grow in the Arctic anytime soon, but what you might see is a desertification in the northern area, especially northern parts of Canada. And then in the Eurasia area, they actually have a lot more precipitation. So they're still in this kind of honeymoon greening phase. But who knows? It could be fickle and it switches. So that was
speaking
that
of
was
fickle, people who are complaining about the spring now that, I mean, the snow then now that it's officially the season of spring, some of them, I understand, are blaming Punxsutawney Phil. Not our emissions, not our lifestyle in America, but poor Phil.
Why not?
An easy target, I suppose.
Right. Today's story was, I wrote that too, it was about measuring Boston's metabolism. So we have two professors here, Lucy Hatira and Nathan Phillips, who really focused on trying to measure basically the metabolism of a city, looking at just carbon. So how does the city take it in, digest it, and spit it back out into the atmosphere? And you can imagine how big of a project that is. So we're talking about, you know, dozens of people collaborating with them, not just here, but Harvard, MIT, Northeastern. They're all trying to get a sense of how the city deals with emissions, with kind of an eye to how could we develop policy or inform policymakers about carbon emission standards, you know, and how do you track it? Because there really isn't, from what they're seeing, a reliable method for tracking carbon emissions.
And I think studying the Earth as a live organism, sort of the Gaia concept, is really key in helping us understand that it's all interrelated, we're all connected. It's not a static thing; it's a dynamic, you know, process. And yet, how do you actually, you know, measure how, you know, many global greenhouse gases, or what's the quantity of greenhouse gases coming out of, you know, vehicles, for instance? How can that be isolated?
Right, and that's what they were saying was especially slippery, because you try to measure a vehicle and it's moving, and it's coming in and out of the boundary of the city. So, you know,
literally a moving target.
Yeah, it's a moving target. I think they even said that. And you know, you could stick an instrument on top of a BU roof and measure, you know, how much carbon emission is coming from the buildings or the atmosphere in that particular area. But they have actually some graduate students working on improving emissions tracking specifically for transportation. And they got an IBM Smarter Cities grant to work with Boston city officials to kind of amass all of the information they have about traffic and emissions that they're already collecting. They just hadn't been talking to each other, and create some kind of a transparent portal for people to access. You know, researchers, just people who want to create apps, anybody in the city to see if they can find a better way to track transportation emissions.
And David, are BU students getting involved in this at all, outside perhaps some of the science and, you know, life sciences or environmental studies courses?
Oh, yes. You know, there are both graduate and undergraduate tracks students can pursue. In the Department of Earth and Environment, where a lot of these researchers are, where a lot of these researchers work, and you know, there are student groups on campus as well. The Environmental Student Organization. You may have heard about the fossil fuel divestment movement.
Oh yes,
fossilbuildingchemistry.org.
We cover that heavily. Yes.
Yep. So there is a chapter on the BU campus as well. So, you know, students are studying this and getting involved.
So has BU divested yet, or is that being considered, do you know, or is that top secret?
As far as I know, they have not divested yet.
That's actually a story that's coming up next week that David and I are collaborating on, but that is a push. Divest BU is trying to advocate for that. And Divest BU is the student group here on campus.
Really glad to hear that it's active.
Yeah. Oh, it's definitely. I think from just this past semester in the fall, David, correct me if I'm wrong, they started up and they've just been snowballing since then.
And are there are probably more colleges and universities in Boston than maybe any other city in the United States. I just recently, you know, looked into that again with my daughter applying to schools only in Boston and New York. It seems like that could be a hotbed, pardon the expression, of climate activism.
It seems so. I mean, there's a huge student population, and if there's any type of activism, you know, that's kind of where it begins. So I would think that this is a great city to be part of a movement. There are many like-minded individuals if you're interested in it.
Hmm. And have you guys noticed, you know, just kind of anecdotally or personally, you know, changes in the weather in Boston over the last 5 years or so?
Hmm.
Well, I mean, personally, I moved out to California for 10 years. I was born and raised in the Boston area and moved to California for 10 years. And one of the comments I had when I moved back and, you know, lived through a year here was I never remembered the hurricanes happening on an annual basis. So that's my experience there.
Yeah.
And Leslie?
Well, I grew up in Minnesota, and I moved out here in 2004, so for me it was balmy either way, whether or not it was global climate change. But I think I've found that, you know, you notice things. You notice trees blooming earlier than you thought, you know, the weather just seeming warmer during a winter. But maybe I'm not the best guess since I am coming from the tundra kind of in Minnesota. But I think even there, people have noticed, oh, wow, we're not getting as much snow. You know, we seem to have shorter cold snaps. And these types of things, funny enough, align with what some of these BU researchers are putting out in our series this week.
Well, not last summer, but the summer before, we were in Boston, and I met my co-host, D.R. Tucker, in person for the first time. And I'll never forget, we were having lunch, and we looked outside, and it said on the building across the street that it was 104 degrees. I think that might have been a record for Boston. And I said, I think we need to start a Boston green tea party right here, right now. For those of us who are esteemed about the Tea Partiers not believing in climate change. And we talked about that for a while, but everyone seemed to think that anything with Tea Party in there should not really, Tea Party should not be included in any environmental movement,
right,
because of the negative associations with the Tea Party. But while I'm touching on politics for just a moment, you know, how damaging do you think, you know, it is that we have, you know, such gridlock in, you know, the nation's capital in Congress on, you know, getting a carbon tax passed, or, you know, back in 2010 when only, you know, one half of the legislature passed anything on, you know, the climate change bill. The fact that it's 2013 and we really have not made much progress because mostly, you know, fossil fuel industry funded campaigns. They're quite successful. Let's acknowledge that. You know, Tea Partiers of the 30 that were elected in 2010, not one of them professed to believe in climate change. Looking back, how damaging do you think this disinformation campaign is?
Mm-hmm. I guess from the perspective of some of these professors that we're speaking to, I think it's frustrating for them because, you know, their life is researching these topics and, you know, it's science, it's fact, and that's what they base their lives on, their livelihoods. And I think just in seeing what they're doing, they're taking personal action. I think, for example, Ranga Maneni began this website called Your Climate Change, and he is seeking to get 1 billion signatures by next Earth Day, 2014. I think he has something like 8,000 right now, but it's an open letter to UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and just saying, please do something about climate change. So I think professors who are involved in this feel the need to do something beyond just publish papers. They really want to take action.
And I know I'm wandering a little bit outside the boundaries of what we plan to talk about, but I can't help but ask you, David, just to hear your point of view on, you know, President Obama. Are you expecting better action, more action, real action on climate change in his second term?
Well, I hope so. I mean, you know, personally speaking, I think climate change is probably the greatest challenge that humanity faces today. And just to sort of step back to, you know, what the researchers are doing in our series, there's a great quote at the end of the first story in our series from Bruce Anderson, who says, with regard to mitigation, his research takes us one step further away from the need to do more process-based and scientific studies, and one step closer to actually saying this is a problem that we need to address. So in that sense, whether it's a small step or a large step, it's progress toward that transition from developing scientific questions to developing scientific policies. So, you know, I hope Obama takes greater action in his second term and, you know, that we do develop scientific-based policy.
Mm-hmm. I think, too, tomorrow we're I have a story about Professor Cutler Cleveland, and it's about alternative energies and whether or not, you know, they're viable right now and how close we are to become dependent on alternative energy instead of fossil fuels. And he's deeply involved in helping policymakers understand this issue as well. And I think he, for one, is probably thinking along that same lines. He doesn't have much faith that anything's going to happen, at least in this administration, but it seems like on the ground these professors are trying to get involved in city or local governments to be the voice of science and see how they can benefit policies at a local kind of bottom level. And who knows if it trickles up.
And the article you wrote, Leslie, called Tracking Change, Predicting Trouble, mm-hmm. that was part two, you quoted a College of Arts and Science professor saying, you know, it's the initial gold rush in reference to the fact that winter's getting warmer, spring's coming earlier, plants are enjoying, you know, longer growth seasons, but how that's not really good news because what may seem more comfortable in some areas for some people because that's not, you know, widespread, it's climate chaos, it's, you know, extremes, of right. course, that are the real problem, but what may look okay now is really, you know, kind of going to be bottled up to be disastrous in the not-too-distant future.
Right, right. I mean, we can be excited that it's not as cold during the winter, but what does that mean? And what does that mean for, you know, many of the people and the plants and the animals, I guess, in these northern climates that rely upon a cold and lasting winter? You know, does that mean that these animals and plant species keep migrating north? Well, at a certain point, you don't have any more place to go, and I think that's what's really alarming to these scientists who are both basing their research on satellite data and then what's actually happening on the ground. It's just a big question mark for them.
Since you are both of you on the ground at Boston University, are you seeing an uptick or maybe even a small surge in interest on the part of students in studying science, specifically environmental studies programs? I'm seeing, now that I'm looking closely at university curriculum for my daughter's college career, noticing that many of them are offering that as a major, as a course of study. It makes me, of course, want to go back to school and study that instead of psychology and then journalism. But are we seeing it reflected, this concern that we hope is out there, you know, in this next generation?
David, you probably have a better handle on that one.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't have any, you know, actual statistics there, and I'm not exactly familiar with the programs at other universities, but I was impressed to find how much, you know, climate change-related research is going on at Boston University, and top-notch research at that, and I'm actually in taking a class this semester with Professor Cutler Cleveland, who will be featured in our article tomorrow in the Climate Crisis series about energy transitions. And in my research, as sort of investigating whether or not I want to go into a graduate program in energy and environmental analysis and assessing all the programs offered here, I was really impressed to see how much that area had developed. As far as whether or not, you know, or how many students might be enrolling in scientific programs, and if there's an uptick or not, I don't know. There are a lot of students studying in the Department of Earth and Environment, and that's really encouraging.
Yeah, and I know that Boston University is known for its excellent communication college or department. You know, I've always wondered what is there to study really in communications. I just picked up on some journalism courses at the end of my college career, and yet there is such a need, you know, to communicate more and better and more frequently on climate change, you know, the part of the mainstream media. So I wondered if this could be, you know, a focus in the communications department, just kind of thinking out loud here.
Well, it's funny because there is a science journalism vein in COM, in the College of Communications, and I'm not sure if they specifically focus on, say, the environment, but I got my grad degree from BU, and I know the science program was really strong in the graduate journalism division.
And there's such a need, and yet we're seeing the New York Times, for instance, eliminate its environmental desk and getting rid of its green blog, and CNN, you know, had an environmental science correspondent, Peter Dykstra, who was let go years ago. We're kind of going in the wrong direction as the CO2 goes in the opposite direction. Mm-hmm. It boggles my mind.
Mm-hmm. And then again, you do see, you know, some sites that are kind of popping up, just, you know, folks who've started nonprofits and have a news site attached to it. I know of one anyway based in Rhode Island called EcoRI, and they plan to expand into Massachusetts as well. So maybe there's, you know, more of a grassroots movement that people are switching to, but it is. Surprising, I guess, how decisions are made.
Yeah, and I talk about this probably too much on the show, but just how if we don't see the mainstream commercial media outlets, radio and television, dedicating programming to these many, many issues, it's not just one. You know, people say, oh, the environment, like that's one subject area. The life support system, people, it's very complex, and it's, you know, very urgent, you know, in terms of needing our attention. It really, I think, needs to be someplace where people wouldn't necessarily seek it out who already know quite a bit, already are interested. And so I don't mean to sound, you know, in any way negative about what's out there. I just keep blaming the mainstream media for not getting that this is something that is interesting, it's compelling, can be engaging and even entertaining, and heaven knows, maybe even profitable. But there is no such show, no green talk show anywhere on mainstream airwaves, and that just, again, blows my mind. On good days, it boggles it. On bad days, it blows it. Having been someone who was in mainstream media, had to leave to cover this beat, and still can't get back in. It's just crazy.
Right.
Well, you're doing it, Betsy.
Thank you. God bless you, and God bless you what you're doing there. And I'm really happy to learn more about Boston University, what a great school it is. Totally coincidental to the fact that my daughter just got in.
we'll
I told her she's out of school this week for the spring break, and I said, don't come home till after my show because you're going to think I'm doing this just to suck up to be you. But she's already in. So thank you again, and I'll pop in and say hello next time we're there visiting.
Great. Sounds good. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Great. Thanks for having us on the show.
Thank you. And that does it for this edition of The Green Front. If you joined us in progress, you can find the archives going way back, not only on the Progressive Radio Network site at PRN.FM, but at my site, and that is thegreenfront.com. Want to wish our Jewish listeners a happy Passover. It goes on for another 6 days, and those who are celebrating Easter, have a wonderful Easter, and may spring come soon to a community near you, as it's supposed to be, a la Mother Nature. Have a great green week.